It's been about a week since President Trump tested positive for COVID, had to be hospitalized at Walter Reed Medical Center, but then was treated and released. Our political analyst Neil Milner joins us today for the long view. Hi, Mel. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Catherine.
You know, my head is just reeling. It's been a lot to process this last week.
Well, I can't really unreel your head, but I guess I can explain what happens when, if and when presidents become incapacitated while they're in office. So
yeah.
That's the best I can do for you, Catherine.
Well, have at it, because, you know, that was certainly, a real scare for people.
Well, it's a scare for people for obvious reasons. It's a secondary scare because both of the candidates are up there in age. That is, they're around my age. But there are different scenarios here. So let's start with what would be the easiest about what would happen if a president becomes incapacitated. First of all, you start with the Constitution. It doesn't say much about it. It says that it talks about the president's inability to carry out his or her duties. And then there's an act called the Presidential Succession Act, 1947, with some later modifications. The problem, as you'll see, is no one has ever defined what inability means. But okay, so what happens if the president is unable to carry out the office? Probably the easiest thing is if nobody tells anybody, and that actually happened. Woodrow Wilson, for a year, was incapacitated with a stroke. His wife and a couple of henchmen ran it, and even his vice president didn't know. But that's not likely to happen anymore the way the media works. So the easiest thing now is that if a president knows he or she might be incapacitated for a while, let's say minor surgery, which is what George Bush did, you can turn it over pretty much informally to your vice president. So for you Dick Cheney fans, for a brief moment in time, Dick Cheney was president of the United States. And that's the easiest way. But that's not really the way that people worry about. The real way is, what if a sitting president, becomes incapacitated but has never given up delegated, turned over the presidency, at least temporarily, to the vice president? One, because he is unwilling to do so, but the more common reason may be that the president may have had a stroke and is unconscious. The president didn't have a chance to do anything. So there is a process that the Presidential Succession Act allows that says that if a president seems to be unable to carry out the office, a committee composed of the vice president and the cabinet members take a vote on whether or not the president should continue his duties, and they send the results of that to Congress. If the majority voted in favor of doing it, then the majority of this committee, and then the committee, then the vice president takes over until further notice, or until the president actually takes back the power. So that's one situation. Even so, there still is this issue that says the inability is still undefined. So the 1947 Act says if a president pushes back on the certification, I mean, let's say the president is conscious but is unwilling to accept this, and that's not hard to imagine, because it's sometimes if you have a significant stroke, you could be in that kind of position. In that case, the president, that group of the vice president and the cabinet members, take another vote. They have 4 days to go back to Congress with their certification. That certification has to be approved. Now, listen to the numbers here. By two-thirds of the vote of both the House and the Senate, which is a higher number than you need for impeachment, if you don't get the vote, then the president stays president regardless of how incapacitated he may be or she may be. So you can see it works okay when there's voluntarily delegated authority. But as soon as it's not voluntary and you have to rules, that's when it gets difficult. And with certain kinds of presidents, you can see that kind of problem happening.
I'm so just amazed that, you know, somebody has to really think of these scenarios.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there's some secession scenarios where the president pro tem, we'll talk about this in the next show, the president pro tem of the Senate becomes the president. That would be Chuck Grassley right now, who makes Donald Trump and Joe Biden like spring chickens. Grassley's 87 years old. So now the final thing is, what happens if a presidential candidate dies before the election? And, of course, that was one of the concerns when with Donald Trump when he caught the serious disease. So this is where it really can get very dicey. The first thing that happens is that you have to choose a new candidate, and that's up to the respective political party. So if a Democratic candidate, you know, the nominee for president, dies before the election, then the Democratic National Committee has a mini convention, basically. They have their own rules. Republican National Committee has similar rules. And they would select in a mini convention who would be the representative from all states. Okay, now, think about where we are right now if that would happen. That works fine if you got a lot of time. Like, say, the conventions were in August, and one candidate passed away, say, in September. But what happens now, a month before the election, when ballots are going out, in some places people have already voted? Can you get a new person on the ballot? How, if the ballots have already gone out? And what makes that, so there's a logistic problem, and what makes it even harder, it sounds like I'm working out the world's hardest mathematical problem and the most depressing one. What happens is that ballot eligibility, like most voting rules, are up to the state. So you really can have 50 different set of rules. Does the state even allow for a change on the ballot? If so, by what deadline? And you add that to, is it even possible? Is there even time to do it? So, and my guess is that from now on, that's going to be a more pressing question. From now on, I mean past 2020, because there's just more mail-in ballots than there used to be. So it's quite possible that at least in some states, maybe more than some, the deceased name would appear on the ballot. That's where we're going to end this explanation today, but you can see what the next question is. What happens under those circumstances if a deceased person gets elected to be president of the United States? There are some ways of dealing with it according to rules and constitutions, but if you toss that question into the turmoil that's likely to accompany the 2020 election, including refusal to accept results, the likelihood of a lot of litigation, and the fact that it is possible by law to manipulate the electors, it could really get sticky. But that's a sneak preview for the next show.
Well, I know if you say that it varies from state to state about, you know, what could happen in this last scenario.
Yeah.
You know, this report says, well, this could lead to a whole lot of mischief, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we'll get to the mischief in detail, but one possibility is that if a state, let's say a state has a Republican governor and a Republican legislature, but a Democrat wins the state, there is some talk about the fact that the legislature would appoint a different set of electors that could vote, that would not vote in the way that the state voted. Now, this is above and beyond a deceased candidate. That's just a regular candidate. And the Supreme Court, it used to be that the state legislature selected electors. We moved away from that. But the U.S. Supreme Court has essentially said it's possible that the states could take that power back, even if they gave it away before. That's all kinds of hanky-panky are possible there.
Okay, well, I don't really even want to think about, you know, refusal to accept the results, but that is another subject for another day.
Yes, that's right.
All right, thanks so much, Neil.
You're welcome. Take care.
That was Neil Milner, retired political professor at the University of Hawaii and our contributing analyst here on The Long View.